He's conducted cultural diplomacy missions in over 30 countries for the U.S. State Department. Last year, he was appointed by President Obama to the National Council on the Humanities. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we check in with Christopher Merrill, director of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. Chris has just returned from a month-long trip on behalf of the program that took him to Baghdad and the Kurdish part of Iraq, also Abu Dhabi and Turkey, and he's about to leave for Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Also, at the end of the hour, we'll talk with the National Weather Service to find out what's up with the weather. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And for most of our hour today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Christopher Merrill, the director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program. He also serves on the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO. He's conducted cultural diplomacy missions in many, many countries, over 30 countries for the U.S. State Department. Last year, you may remember, in 2012, President Obama appointed Chris Merrill to the National Council on the Humanities. He's the author of 4 collections of poetry, 5 books of nonfiction. Chris Merrill, welcome to our program.
Nice to be with you, Ben.
Before you sat down, you came into the studio just a moment ago. We have a nice big map of the Middle East on the wall behind you. You were going quickly over dotting, putting your finger where you have been in the last month in the Middle East, a month-long trip on behalf of the International Writing Program. It took you to the Middle East, to Baghdad, to the Kurdish part of Iraq, to the United Arab Emirates, to Turkey. I'm sure I'm leaving out some of these. And tomorrow you're leaving for Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. So this is a great chance for us to catch up with some of your personal observations, but also, Chris, you're a unique individual in that we get not only the political developments in the region, which we do from NPR News and a variety of news outlets, but also how the cultural developments behind these political developments occur at the same time and go hand in hand. How should we start? Should we start with the United Arab Emirates, sort of chronologically, your last month?
Yeah, the safest place.
Okay. The reason for that trip to Abu Dhabi?
Well, we've been working very hard with the Public Affairs Office in Abu Dhabi and with an alum of the International Writing Program, Sheikha Al-Maskari, to set up what we hope will eventually be an IWP satellite campus in the United Arab Emirates. It's a place of bustling energy, a lot of international businesses. So I traveled there with Natasha Trethewey, the current U.S. Poet Laureate, and we did a number of programs at the American University of Sharjah, at NYU Abu Dhabi. We gave readings. We gave master classes. We met with different people from around the country to try to get take the temperature of the place, see what might be possible. Could we make those connections between Arab and American writers that we're hoping to make?
Why would Abu Dhabi be a good place for an IWP satellite camp?
Because, for one thing, it's safe. All of the Gulf region is pretty is very prosperous, and it's safe, with the exception of the country of Bahrain, which is the tiny little island off the coast of Saudi Arabia. That's a flashpoint. But it's also the case that in Abu Dhabi, as in Dubai, they are actively seeking engagement with businesses and with universities from around the world. Dubai hopes to become the biggest airport hub in the world, and so we think that we have this great brand as the writing university. Mm-hmm. We can connect on the literary level in that part of the world.
You said it's a wealthy part of the world. In fact, one of the richest cities in the world.
Do you get
that sense walking down the streets of Abu Dhabi?
Oh, yes. People drive very fancy cars. On our last night, I was just writing something about having a dinner on a beach at a brand new 5-star hotel, and what skittered across the table between our salad plates was a scorpion. And I thought, oh, this is a great emblem of very, very first world next to, well, a scorpion can kill you.
Now, what interest do they have more specifically about a cultural connection, a writing connection with the United States, and specifically to the Iowa connection?
Well, in Abu Dhabi, they are building, to great fanfare, a new Getty Museum, a new Museum of the Louvre in Paris, a huge national museum. They are actively trying to get universities involved. MIT has a zero emissions village there where they're doing research on alternative energy sources. The Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania has established a research center there. Iowa has one of its brand names, its writing. So the thought is, if we could figure out a place to bring together some of the many people from the 300 million Arabs in 22 countries, if we could bring them together in one place to bounce off of American writers and students, we will make new connections. We hope, create enduring connections, collaborations that might lead to something new.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Chris Merrill, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, talking about his month-long trip. If you'd like to join us with your comments, your questions about cultural diplomacy, that's really at the heart of this trip that Chris takes and the activity that he's been engaged in for a very long time as part of the over 12 years, over a decade as part of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. From Abu Dhabi to Iraq?
I went from there I flew to Amman, Jordan, where you pick up an embassy air flight to Baghdad. You'd then take a helicopter across that city to the embassy where I was staying. And I was following up on a trip I made there last fall where I came up with an idea in a meeting with the Deputy Minister of Culture. 2013, Baghdad is the Arab cultural capital, and we were trying to figure out different things that might be done during that year, and it occurred to me that as someone coming from Iowa City, the UNESCO City of Literature, I said to the deputy minister, what if you rounded off the year as the cultural capital of the Arab world by submitting a dossier to become a UNESCO City of Literature?
Does the Arab world have one thus far?
There is not a single creative city in the UNESCO Creative Cities Network in the Arab world, with the exception of Aswan in Egypt, which is in folklore. Now, Baghdad has a glorious tradition as a center of intellectual and artistic production. For the last 50 years, of course, it's been a disaster. But the future could be bright if the right people were brought around the table. The minister got so excited. He said to me at one point, my mind is churning with ideas, because I think he saw this as a way to bridge sectarian divides. If you could bring Sunnis and Shias to the table, if you could bring Arabs and Kurds to the table to create a common vision of what a literary city would look like in the future, then that might be a hopeful sign. So we convened a meeting in the embassy following up on a delegation that we had sent to the United States, including to Iowa City, to see what a city of literature might be all about. Mm-hmm. And we had a very lively meeting. Tempers flaring and people.
Tempers flaring over what?
The minister said, "Theaters. We have plenty of theaters." And an Iraqi poet said, "We have one theater in the whole city." And then the municipal okay. official came in and said, "Oh no, we'll build malls." And so I said, "This can be part of the vision that you create. You only have one theater. Well, you need more. Write that into the vision." At the end of the meeting, there was a common agreement that they would work together. 2 days later, they met with the UNESCO representative who was traveling from Amman, and they've already got this thing in gear. So, where it will lead, no one knows, but it has the parties talking, and they're trying to think about a way forward. And Iowa City, as a city of literature, can play a mentoring role with our Baghdadi.
In what ways? In what ways, for instance?
Here's a good example. They said, "But we don't teach creative writing here." And I said, "Yes, but in Iowa City, we have only a history of about 100 years, so we had to play up the fact that we teach creative writing." I said, "You've been producing poets for about 1,000 years. You might talk about that as a part of your legacy and think about how you will move forward." A light bulb went off at that point, and then they began to see how they could structure their dossier, and of course we'll help them with that as we move along.
Can you give us a sense of Iraqi literature, the themes? It does go back over 1,000 years, as you say.
Yeah.
What are the writers and the poets addressing in their writing?
Well, one of the poets who was in our program a few years ago, Nasir Hussain, is one of the most interesting avant-garde poets that I have encountered anywhere. And he told me about the new book. We're publishing some of it in a journal called Two Lines, how he wrote this book. He said, you know, for 40 days, I just wandered around Baghdad. This is during the Civil War. And he said, I would just sort of sniff things in the air and then go home and write about them. So it's a very fragmented kind of lyric exploration of a city at war. Of course, people are writing a lot about the violence, about the upheaval, mm-hmm. and that's what you need to write about at such a moment. And at some point down the line, we imagine there will be more domestic dramas that they can write about.
It's very interesting. This is not something we have covered in our news typically. Yeah. When you think of Baghdad, you don't think of creative expression normally, but of course creative expression happens in the most peaceful places and the most war-torn places, and often the best come from the war-torn places.
Exactly.
You've been to many of them.
Yeah, and you know, I met a professor who was just putting together an anthology of poems and stories written during the last 10 years of violence, and he's trying to study how the violence has shaped the writing. I can tell you, I went to the Baghdad Book Fair and was asked to give my greetings and give a reading. And I walked into this book fair expecting it to be, you know, kind of shabby, chaotic. I had just been to the book fair in Abu Dhabi. I had just been before that to the LA Times book fair. And I walked in and it was like walking into a book fair anywhere on the planet. Perfectly neat, families walking around trying to buy books from 345 publishers from around the Middle East. A reading, a gallery with artwork. I thought I could be anywhere, except that I didn't understand the poems being read by my Iraqi and Bahraini and Qatari colleagues.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, U.S. military operations ended in mid-December of 2011.
Yeah.
What kind of American presence do you experience in Iraq and in Baghdad? And then we wanted to go to another area, the Kurdish area of Iraq, in just a moment. But generally speaking, what do you find there that's American still?
Well, the drawdown is significant. At the embassy alone, the figure is they will draw down from 16,000 personnel to about 6,000 by the end of this year. You only see a handful of soldiers. To travel around the city with the embassy, you have to go with a security detail. It's still not safe for an American to wander around without body armor. We're still targets.
Did you wear body armor at times?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Whenever we made what's called a movement into the city, you wear body armor under a sport jacket. So, you know, that part of it is – that continues. But the thing I would take away from all of this is that regardless of what one felt about the invasion and the occupation, I have met so many Iraqis who are very happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, and they are very eager to engage with the West. There's a sense in which they have been trapped in this bubble for about 40 or 50 years. They have not been – they've been cut off from the world. They lived in a police state, and now they want desperately to engage with Americans, with Westerners. They want their kids to go to universities in the West. They want chances. And
But we're excluding the fundamentalist faction within Iraq as well.
Yeah,
they wouldn't want anything but what you just described.
The bad guys are still there. I was there in the bloodiest week really since the Civil War. An awful lot of people were killed, a lot of car bombings. As one official said to me, it's possible that they just don't have all the killing out of their system yet. But the majority of the people want to move forward. That's the takeaway. Of course, the security concerns are absolutely paramount.
Mm-hmm. What questions do you get from Iraqis, and I suppose primarily people in officialdom there in Iraq, but also writers, of course? The questions you get from them when they see you're an American, do they have questions about the U.S. or what's most on their mind when they can pick your mind?
Yeah. Well, writers and students want to find out who to read. They want to know who are the writers, not just contemporary writers, but who are the 20th century writers to read? Who are the 19th century writers to read? Their curriculum is largely British literature. They were a mandate of the Brits. So they don't have as much contact with American literature as they might have. So when I go, I talk about American writers. I talked a lot about Whitman and Emily Dickinson and the great writers in our tradition, just to give them insight into what else is going on out there in the world. So again, it's a hunger for the news of the outside world.
Mm-hmm. You have written many books, many book collections of poetry, often religious themes. I see that reports say that overall the Christian population in Iraq has dropped by as much as 50% since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Many fleeing to Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. What sense do you get, if any, of the Christian community left in Iraq?
It's very small, very small. I think it's less than 400,000 people are left. And that exodus has been going on now for 20 years, and it's common throughout the Middle East, particularly in the wake of the Arab uprising. And it's, you know, it's a huge part of our history that's vanishing into exile.
Mm-hmm. What else do you tell Arab writers, readers, to read that comes from this continent?
One of the things I say is that they would be surprised at how much interest there is among American readers and writers to know about their world. I remind them that after 9/11, there was a huge upsurge in people finding books on Islam. There was a sense that we actually didn't know very much about it. And, of course, when the civil war broke out between the Sunnis and the Shias, most Americans didn't have much of a sense of that, including many policymakers. And so we've had to get a short course in that or an extended course in that, an education. And I think that Iraqis are surprised to find out that Americans are willing to undertake that hard work to try to find that stuff, find that information out.
Is the language you're working in translated all into English?
When I was in Baghdad, it's in English. We're translating from Arabic into English. When I went north to Kurdistan, the operating language was English, but translation from Kurdish into English. And there I found what was interesting up there was that for a long time, the second language, of course, for a Kurd would be Arabic. Now the second language is English. I gave a workshop at the American University of Sulaymaniyah up on the Iranian border. All the instruction is in English.
So tell us a little bit more about this. When you move from Baghdad, you go north into this area. And when we say Kurdistan, we're really talking about not a country politically defined, but the area it encompasses, the northern part of Iraq. Where else? It goes into
– Well, it's the northern part of Iraq, but it also spills over into Iran, into Syria, and into Turkey. And I happened to be there at the moment that the Turkish government had just negotiated a withdrawal of the PKK. That would be the rebel Kurdish party, the Kurdistan Workers Party, from Turkey into Kurdistan in Iraq.
So and this is a big deal. Decades long.
Thousands
conflict.
Of people killed, and that negotiation to bring the PKK into a safe haven in Iraq and therefore lay down their arms is really one of the biggest developments in the region because it signals a lot of things. You may remember President Obama negotiated a conversation between Netanyahu and the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan. And there was an apology made there. And you look at all the different pieces of this puzzle, the peacekeepers on the Golan Heights in Israel, the civil war in Syria, the PKK withdrawing from Turkey, and you see a lot of diplomatic developments that could bode well, but we have no idea where it's all going to end up.
No idea. Possibly a proper Kurdish state or this autonomous region within Iraq.
Well, the autonomous region within Iraq is completely autonomous. The difference between Baghdad and, let's say, Erbil and then further north in Sulaymaniyah is night and day. You're in a beautiful country. You have really very little fear for your life. There is a great deal of fighting going on in Kirkuk, a city that was traditionally Kurdish, has now become largely much more Arabic as a result of Saddam's policies, and it's sitting on a huge reserve of oil. So that's the flashpoint in the region. But Kurdistan proper, it is its own country. Now, of course, if you were to ask a Kurd, should we have our own country, that would be Kurdistan proper, Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. Well, of course, that's a common feeling, but I don't think anybody imagines it's going to happen anytime soon.
Chris Merrill, my guest, the director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, recounting his past month of trips to various places in the Middle East. In Turkey, you participated in something called a wild gathering and it included Afghans and Turks. Tell us about the history here and what was discussed.
This is, I think, one of the craziest and most wonderful ideas we've come up with yet. But I traveled to Iran in 2009 at the tail end of the protests, and I went from Shiraz to Esfahan to Tehran with the idea of trying to see what sort of cultural diplomacy we might be able to enact. And on my last day, I met with the vice president for external affairs at the University of Tehran, and he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, this may sound crazy to you, but because of my late friend, the Kashmiri poet Agha Shahid Ali, a lot of American poets write in your national poetic form, the ghazal." And I said, "What if we were to bring American and Iranian poets together to try to write a book of ghazals?" And he looked at me for about 30 seconds. I'm sure he thought, "Man, this guy is, where is he coming from?" And then he said, "You know, that could work. We might have to do it in a third country." So what we did was we went to Konya, Turkey, which is the home of the great poet Rumi. And there we had this symposium. Now, Rumi is the most popular poet in America. 500,000 copies of his books have been sold here. But he's claimed as the national poet by Afghans, Turks, Kurds, Arabs, and Persians, Iranians. So I thought, what if I bring together all these different people together to see if we can write a book together and make a film about it? So we had two professors from the University of Tehran. We had two Iranian exiles. We had four Afghan writers from different tribes. We had a Syrian Kurd living now in exile in Paris. We had a fiction writer from Karachi. We had three Turks. And we had the most lively conversation, always, it seemed to me, on the edge of an explosion. But people got along. The excursions served to smooth things over. We watched the whirling dervishes in Konya, that these beautiful dances with the robes flowing around. And at the end, everybody managed to get along. The Iranians all became friends. The Afghans wondered about one of their members. Was he Taliban? And it was lots of intrigue. But at the end, I think we'll end up with a pretty good film and in an interesting book.
For those of us who have only perhaps read a few poems of Rumi, this poet from many hundreds of years ago. Why is he popular? I don't even know. Perhaps you could recite some. I don't want to put you on the spot, but what is a ghazal, and who tell us more about Rumi?
Well, here's the one that we used as the header for our gathering. Our gathering was called The Same Gate, and it goes like this. Inside the great mystery that is, we don't really own anything. What is this competition we feel then before we go one at a time through the same gate? And what you feel about Rumi is he's got this incredible wisdom. And the story about him is that he was just a religious scholar until the age of 37, when he met this wandering dervish, this mystic named Shams. And for 3 years, they spent all their time together talking and praying. And then Shams was murdered. And at that point, Rumi became this incredible poet who would kind of whirl around in grief, and these ghazals, these couplets would just spill out of him, and his students would write them down. Thousands, tens of thousands of ghazals that in one way or another seemed to capture something essential about the human experience.
Mm-hmm. The same gate, is that mortality?
It's mortality. We're all going to die. So what's this competition on the way to that?
We are not going to end right here with Chris Merrill quite yet. We're going to come back with a break. Chris Merrill, my guest. He's the director of the International Writing Program, recounting his last month of trips, visits to various places in the Middle East for the International Writing Program. Interesting discussion about politics, cultural diplomacy. If you have a question or a comment, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, I think we have a few other things to talk about. Talk about perhaps how Syria in our news ties in to some of the areas that Chris has visited. Also, upcoming visits to Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. We'll find out about those when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Don't forget tomorrow, Wednesday, Politics Day here on the program. Be talking a lot about domestic politics. Of course, you've caught many of those news headlines that we'll be discussing with our analysts tomorrow. Domestic politics today on River to River, for the most part, we're casting our glance outside of the country. At the end of the hour, we'll be talking about some of weird roller coaster weather we've been having in terms of temperature. We'll get analysis from a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Finishing up our conversation with Christopher Merrill, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. He's been on many cultural diplomacy missions in over 30 countries. He's just returned from a month of various stops in the Middle East, and we've been talking about those in our first half hour. Chris Merrill, I wanted to ask you, of course, Syria, big in the news in this area this time around, though you have in the past been to Syria. This time around, no stop in Syria for you, but it has to be the number one point of conversation in many of the areas that you've been visiting, in Iraq, in Turkey, various other places. What are the people of that region saying about the developments in Syria and what it portends for the future of Syria and the region?
Yeah. Well, this is the $64,000 question, because it's weighing on everybody's minds. You have 70,000 people killed already in this two-year-long civil war. In recent weeks, red lines have been crossed, so it seems. The Assad regime being accused of using chemical weapons on its own civilians. The strain on neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan in particular, is enormous.
Due to the refugees.
A million refugees in each country, in Jordan and Lebanon. And then in Lebanon's case, you have the fact that the country is effectively divided between Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed militia, quasi-government structure, and the Sunni Christians and Druze and Sunnis, Christians, and Druze. So Hezbollah is messing around in Syria. Iran is funneling arms and money into Syria. Russia stands as a protector. The U.S. is trying to figure out which rebels to arm and how to support them. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are providing the arms, but it's an incredibly complicated and volatile mix of personalities, and the carnage has been incredible. Everyone fears that it will spiral out of control.
It is something that we saw in the worst periods in Iraq.
Yeah, exactly. It bears the earmarks of the fighting in Iraq. Alawites, Sunnis, Shia. The Alawites are like a sect of the Shia Muslims, and so they are backed by Iran. And it also looks, for me, as someone who covered the war in the Balkans, it looks a lot like the ethnic cleansing, the wars that we saw there too. So these are really complicated conflicts to get caught up in. Not really sure what to do about that. And you couple things with uncertain intelligence about who's doing what and to whom, it raises the ante even more.
Of course, with your experience in the Balkans, you know what you're talking about. You've written about it. You were there present for some of the siege of Sarajevo. Let's talk a little bit about where you're going. I understand. Is it tomorrow already? Do they give you a chance to rest, Chris, at all?
Yeah, this is a trip that I didn't even quite get my luggage back before I'm taking off again.
So where are you going to tomorrow?
Tomorrow we fly to Tashkent in Uzbekistan, and it will be a cultural diplomacy mission in both Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, two republics founded after the demise of the Soviet Union, famous for being on the Silk Road. We have an interesting wrinkle on this cultural diplomacy mission, in the sense that we're bringing the wonderful poet and prose writer Steve Kuzisto, who used to be here at the University of Iowa. He helped to found our disability studies program.
In fact, he's been on this program before, Steve.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm.
And wonderful.
And we have on this mission, we're always trying to do people-to-people contact, but in this case, we also want to highlight disability studies. And this builds on a program of the USAID to earmark funds throughout the stands to improve awareness of disability studies and to of disability studies, as well as to make places more accessible to the disabled.
And when you bring disability studies to a place like Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, Do they study such things as well? Do they accommodate? Do they have their awareness? How is that in relation to where we are?
Well, that's one of the designs is to introduce the idea in the same way that we introduce the idea of teaching a creative writing workshop. The pedagogy of creative writing is one part of our mission. Another part in this case is to talk about disability studies. In other missions that we've done, we're thinking about how to write in a state of reconstruction. What do you do after a war? How do you rebuild a place? How do you write in the midst of the Arab uprising? I was in Bahrain at one point, and that was one of the issues that we tried to address there.
Mm-hmm. These are two countries, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, that are sort of still coming out of the Soviet occupation, yep, which ended quite a long time ago in the period of Gorbachev. But still, what are the connections that linger there?
Well, the connections, the principal connection to Moscow would be in the Russian populations in each country, the so-called near abroad. They're a small part of the equation, I think maybe 5% in Uzbekistan, 9-10% in Turkmenistan. That would be the connection to Moscow. But there are other connections for us. These are transportation routes into Afghanistan. Turkmenistan is sitting on a lot of oil and natural gas. So there are other reasons why diplomatic efforts would be made in these countries, not just by the United States, of course. China, Russia, all the great powers are involved in trying to do work in different places of strategic interest.
Mm-hmm. When you go on these diplomatic, cultural diplomatic missions, do you have specific goals in mind when you set out? Do you put pen to paper or finger to iPad, I don't know, and type out, this is what I want to accomplish? Or are you listening, I matter, in early stages and then having ideas together with the counterparts you have there?
That's exactly how it works. We have general ideas of markers we want to hit, but the key part of cultural diplomacy is listening. So you walk into a situation and you're not quite sure what's going to be happening. I'll give you an example. Just in Baghdad, we went to a university that the embassy hadn't worked there before. So we went in. I had the notion I might be teaching a creative writing workshop. That was what was on the schedule. And we had our meeting with the rector, and he hands me a program, and he says, here's the title of your lecture that you'll give in 10 minutes. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. It was far removed from anything I had managed to think about. And then we walked outside to go to this auditorium, and the head of the security detail pulled us aside, the American diplomat and me, and said, gentlemen, I need 2 minutes of your time. And he pulled us aside and said, there was just a big fight here right outside the door. There's a lot of tension in the air. So if I tell you you have to get off the stage right now, you have to get off the stage right now. So I walked into this auditorium. There's about 150 students and teachers, and I'm being introduced by the rector, and I'm thinking, this is the oddest lecture I have ever given, you know, thinking, how is this going to go? And so I started to talk a little bit about why I was there and about writing and about literature. And before I knew it, they were raising their hands. We were having questions, and it was just flying, you know. And it was, it was them listening to me and me listening hard to them and trying to answer their questions as honestly as I could. As an American poet, as an American writer, in a land where they are just used to seeing American soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Are you ever told on a cultural diplomatic mission, perhaps by a government official like this, a security official, what you should stay away from in terms of topic, content, anything?
No. We are, especially the writers that I bring along, we know that we say to them, look, you are free Americans, and if you don't feel free to speak candidly, then this whole mission falls apart. So speak freely. In an Islamic country, you kind of know, well, talking about graphic sex would be that would be discourteous, and so you wouldn't want to do that. And that's part of listening. You're in a new culture, and when you're in a conversation with somebody, you figure out what the proper boundaries are, and then you obey them.
Chris Merrill, we have about a minute left before we wanted to move on here. I know you have to go as well. Can I ask you to end with a little bit about our beloved poet Rumi?
Well, why don't I read you this great little ghazal from Rumi in a translation by W.S. Merwin, often a visitor to the University of Iowa. I just love this. The world breaks apart. The soul is flooded. The pearl that dissolves into water is embraced by the water and reborn from the water.
That's beautiful.
And maybe one more. Do we have time?
Very quickly, yes.
When the heart bursts into flame, it swallows up the believers and the faithless together. When the bird of truth opens its wings, all the images fly away. And now I'm going to fly away.
How suitable to end with that, Chris Merrill. We wish you uneventful travel in terms of safety. We wish you all the best in terms of safety. And we'll hear when you get back about your other travels. Thank you very much, Christopher Merrill, Director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program.
Don't cry. Don't cry. Don't cry. No, 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 no. It's summertime. And the living is easy. Fish are jumping.
Summertime. Well, it sure does feel like summertime today, even though we have just the middle of May. Hey, wasn't it just last week that we had very cold temperatures, even some snow in the state? Let's find out about our wild weather ride from Kevin Scow. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Seems like wild swings in temperature after very cold temperatures in the last few days, possibly seeing some record highs today. Describe what's been going on over the last couple of weeks, and from your perspective as a meteorologist, the extreme or unusual things we're experiencing.
Yeah, right now the spring has generally been characterized as abnormally cold. Temperatures here at Des Moines in Iowa in general have been running below normal for much of March and April, and primarily we've just had a very cold air mass across the state, and now finally we're getting a shot of warm air from the southern U.S. that's worked its way up here finally, and so that's what's bringing these warmer temperatures finally.
You know, we've had these drastic shifts. It was a couple weeks ago we had, what did we have? Within a few hours, the later part of one day, we had a 55-degree temperature difference.
Indeed, yes. It was a very, very sharp cutoff. And again, we just had a very, very active weather system move through us, a very powerful weather system. So we had that very sharp gradient across us, and it helped pull in all that cold Canadian air across our area that we had last couple weeks ago.
I'm curious, when we have these wild swings in temperature, I always associate, well, if you're going to get a temperature change, you're often going to have a storm. But sometimes you do not have that. You just have the temperature change and no storm. What determines whether you have a storm or not when you have a significant shift in temp?
There's a number of factors that go into whether or not you're going to have a storm. One of them is, you know, your temperature differences, and those form what are called boundaries, you know, your cold fronts, your warm fronts. Other things you need a good source of moisture. You need a good source of lift as well. And so some of those weren't coming together to form storms, so that's the reason why some of these fronts have come through dry, and some of them came through very wet. We saw an example of that with our record snowstorm earlier in May.
Mm-hmm. What part of the state did that hit?
That hit much of western and even central Iowa. The axis of heaviest snow actually fell just to the east of Des Moines, believe it or not. It fell from south central Iowa up into north central Iowa, where some areas had anywhere from 9 inches to over a foot of snow.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand the northwest half of the state also has a red flag warning. Remind us what that means and how often we see that in Iowa.
Yes, definitely. Red flag warnings are issued when there is conditions are conducive for if we have any fires that are caused by, say, any farmers lighting fires or any wildfires that start up. Conditions are conducive for those fires to get out of control very quickly, and that is caused by both a combination of relative humidity, like very low relative humidity values, which is a combination of both temperature and your dew point, and also wind speeds. And also we also look at the conditions of the fuels, the grass, the crops in the field, if there are any. We look at those in determining whether or not the wildfire potential is very high. So in our case, the wind speeds generally have to be above 25 miles an hour, and relative humidity values below 25% for red flag warnings. And they're most common in the spring and in the fall months. In the summer, we have a very moist air mass over us. Crops are maturing. They're very green, and they don't burn very well. So you tend to see red flag warnings more in the spring and the fall.
Mm-hmm. Is the northwest part of the state also where there may be a bit of the effects of drought hanging on?
Yeah, the northwest part of the state still has some lingering effects of the drought going on. Thankfully, we've seen quite a bit of precip here in the last couple of months, and that's eased at least the short-term drought across the state. And then much of southern and eastern Iowa has seen the bulk of the precipitation, and northwest Iowa has seen some, but not quite as much.
Mm-hmm. If we look at a larger picture of the Midwest as a whole, where is the drought? Is it being pushed or remains to the west of us or to the south of us as well?
Yeah, exactly. The worst drought conditions remain primarily to the west and to the south of us, and conditions here in Iowa, again, have been slowly easing over the course of the last couple of months. We've seen above normal precipitation here in Des Moines through the course of the year, but again, that's only relieved the short-term drought. We were below average here in Des Moines, and over 10 inches of rainfall last year, and we're only above average by about 3 inches this year. So if you look at the two-year running total of precip, we're still running below average, and we could still use some more precipitation to recharge the groundwater.
Mm-hmm. How does that work, the recharging the groundwater? Why does it take so often? So
it takes a long time because, you know, the ground, it takes time for the water to percolate through the soil and to reach down to the water tables that we use, and it just takes time for them to recharge. It just takes... And generally, just sometimes if the rain falls on the soil, it can evaporate very quickly if it's warm out. And so all the rainfall that falls may not actually go into the ground. It may run off into the rivers. It may evaporate. So there's more things. The rain doesn't always reach into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm. We've had these two back-to-back springs that are very different in nature. Last year, the 2012 spring, very warm, very early. I think relatively little precipitation this year. Colder with a lot of precipitation. Does that happen often?
It is unusual to have such extreme springs back to back, but it certainly isn't unheard of. Spring is generally a time of transition here in the state. In the case of 2012, the spring was just unusually warm. It was actually the warmest March, in particular the month of March, it was the warmest March on record here in the state of Iowa. And we just happened to have a very stagnant weather pattern where we had a very strong area of high pressure over us that brought us very warm temperatures. And here we've had almost the inverse. We've had a very cold air mass over us. So it's been a very consistent weather pattern, but it's been on the extreme side both times for each year.
One of the noteworthy things about our weather is that we heard that there's been very little tornadic activity. No tornadoes since when in the state?
Since May 24th of last year.
So how often does that sort of thing happen?
That is definitely unusual. May 24th was actually the earliest ending to the tornado season in Iowa since our record-keeping began. Usually we tend to see tornadoes into the months of June, July, and August. Even later, we've seen tornadoes actually every month of the year here in the state of Iowa. But generally, our tornado season runs from May, June, and July. And to have the tornado season end on May 24th was almost essentially unheard of. The previous record that it shattered was on July 11th. So July 11th of 2011 actually was the last time, was the previous early ending of the season record, and then we broke it on May 24th last year.
How do you explain that? A fluke or something else going on?
Well, the ending of the tornado season last year so early was a result, again, of those drought conditions we had. So as I said earlier, what you need for thunderstorm development, you need that moisture, you need that source of lift. And in both cases, last summer, we just didn't have that. We had very warm, very dry air over us, and not many weather fronts came through. So we didn't have any of the ingredients there for the development of storms. And with this year, so far this spring, we've had weather systems come through, but it's been very cold, and we don't have that warm, moist air coming up from the south that is generally needed for tornadoes to form. So that's the reason why tornadoes haven't formed so far this year. It's been kind of a mixed reasoning. Last year was the warm, dry, and this year it's the cool, and it is rather moist, but it's just been cool has been the primarily reason why they haven't formed.
Does that mean for this spring that tornado season is also I guess to put a damper on it.
It's a little too early to tell at this point. Mm-hmm. Definitely, we've had again until then the very late start. It actually isn't the latest start to our season. The latest start actually was on June 1st of 2010. So we have seen the tornado season start later before. And generally, by this time of the year, we see about 13 to 14 tornadoes in a given year. But it's still a little too early to tell if this means we're going to have a below normal tornado season.
What is the beginning? Is there an exact date for the beginning of tornado season?
There really isn't. The beginning of tornado season that we call it is generally when tornado activity really starts to ramp up in the state on average. I mean, again, we've seen tornadoes in the state of Iowa every month of the year, and we've even seen some very powerful outbreaks even in the wintertime months, especially we had some back, I believe, in the 60s. But the beginning of the tornado season for us, generally we start to see activity begin to ramp up sometime in the month of April, and that continues going up in the months of May and June. And tends to peak in the months of June, early July, and then starts to fall off during August. So we define tornado season just basically when the activity is at its greatest on average.
Finally, Kevin Scow, if we could do a long and short-term look at the crystal ball, let's try the harder one, the longer term. What kind of summer are we headed for as far as you can tell at this point?
Again, it's a little too early to tell. Generally, I believe we're heading for, I think the chances are pretty normal for our summer so far. At this point, we're expecting about normal temperatures, maybe slightly above normal temperatures as the further south you go. But in general, that's what our summer is shaping up to be so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next few days, up to a week, what does that look like?
So today will be our warmer day. Definitely, we're expecting highs in the mid to upper 90s, especially across western Iowa, where that red flag warning is in effect. But after that, we're going to have a cold front swing through the state. Late tonight into tomorrow might bring a couple of thunderstorms to the area. Temperatures on Wednesday will drop off into the mid-70s north to low 80s south. And that will kind of be the trend for the rest of the week temperature-wise, looking for readings again in the mid to upper 70s. Through the course of the rest of the week. And that cold front will actually stall out over southern Iowa and northern Missouri, help bring off and on chances of thunderstorms to basically the southern third or southern half of Iowa through the end of the week. And then that system will actually lift back north over the weekend, and we could see another shot of strong to maybe even severe thunderstorms for the weekend.
Kevin Scow, meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Des Moines, thank you for keeping us up to speed on this wild weather we've been having, Kevin.
You're very welcome.
And that does it for us today. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. You can find podcasts or on-demand audio of our program at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.